So what do you got for us today, Pete?
Oh, man, I got some good stuff. We're talking about Pornhub's 2022 year in review, which has some shocking stats to come out of that this year. Let me tell you. We're also going to talk about an unexpected and sobering phone call that a club member received from his best friend's girlfriend.
Ooh.
So that's pretty spicy.
I smell drama.
And then we'll be responding to an email you got as well.
Oh, yeah. That guy was a dick.
Yeah.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Man vs. World, your companion show to help you confront the insanity that is the modern world for the modern man. So, as always, we are joined by Pete. Pete, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great. How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing good. And yes, as you said, I am Mark Quepet. I am your host here today. And we are going to be getting into some fun stuff that... some of it's a little controversial. We got a bit of a juicy show today.
Ooh, it's juicy.
So, all right, let's go ahead and kick this thing off. Pete, what's our first story here?
So first up, we got, as mentioned, the Pornhub year in review statistics. Every year, apparently, they drop this big old sheet to show you the top categories, the most common searches, all this kind of stuff. And this year, well, in the top categories of the United States, at least, there's a new contender, because in the number four spot,
jeez,
drumroll please, is transgender porn.
Wait, I'm looking at it now. It says outdoors.
No. Here, I'll show it to you.
Well, not the actual porn.
As you can see, the top categories for the categories viewed most often in the United States, number four is transgender.
Interesting.
And we kind of talked about this a couple shows ago now, or maybe it was last show, but it seems to be that... Now, this category was not in there. It was not in the top categories last year, apparently.
Mm. And rocketed all the way up to number four, huh?
It rocketed up to number four. And I looked up, you know, maybe there's more people identifying as transgender or something, but I looked it up, and 2% of the U.S. population total identify as transgender.
Right. And so this is kind of interesting, because like we were talking about morphing sexual tastes and things like that, but there's something beyond that going on here, and it's going to sound weird. And I actually learned this from the late great Gary Wilson. So some of you guys might be familiar with him from his work on yourbrainonporn.com. Like, he's got that famous TED talk where he talks about, you know, how porn is screwing up people's brains. And he was really on the forefront of helping people understand the neuroscience behind porn addiction and things like that. And one time I was talking to him, and I can't remember if this was in a private conversation or if this was in he must have probably said this publicly somewhere, because I'm pretty sure I remember it. But basically, what he was talking about is that even for like heterosexual men, like straight guys, they see an erect penis as a sexual stimuli. And this is why, like, you know, a lot of porn has like, you know, a focus on like a big dick. And the way that I can wrap my head around this as a straight male is that like, it enhances the, what do you want to call it, the fantasy, right? So it's like when you're using porn, you're kind of pretending that you are in it, right? You're pretending that you are having the sexual experience that is on screen. And so it's like, you know, if you're going to be doing that, right, you want to have the best fantasy possible. And for most guys, they want to imagine themselves having a huge old schlong. And so it's like seeing the dick is an essential part of it. And if it's big one, then it's kind of like a superhero fantasy. Like, no one wants to watch follow a superhero that's like completely boring and mundane and normal. They want to see like, you know, a superhero that's got like, you know, he's extra strong and ripped and shit like that, right? And so it's the same kind of thing, but applied to porn. And he said that that's actually one of the ways in which guys can start having their sexual tastes morph. And then, like how we were talking about in the previous show, about how like a guy's sexual taste can move toward even gay porn and stuff like that, because it almost allows them to, you know, there's more focus on the dick. And I think a lot of that has to do with using porn as a status simulation, using it as like this thing where you get to pretend like you are this, you know, more alpha guy, and the large dong or whatever, it acts as like this surrogate measure for you to step into via fantasy. And so it's like you take that, assuming that's true, and then you think about the idea of trans people, right? And especially like, I remember when I was a kid, this I think probably stuff that would be called trans porn today was called shemale porn. Is that I don't know if that's still politically correct to say, but that's what it was. Whereas like basically boobs plus a dick. And I imagine that's what's going on in trans porn, because without that, what even would it be defined as? Like, what even technically would be trans porn? I mean, like, that's what it would have to be, right? Otherwise you wouldn't be able to tell. Like, if they didn't have any sort of alteration, it's not like, unless people are like sitting there getting off to like the preamble where they're swapping pronouns and shit like that, there has to be something else going on there. And my assumption is, you know, female style top, male style bottom. And then you have basically both like sexual parts present, where you've got the dong and the boobs, more or less. And so it's like, we're kind of like, the fact that that's rising up so much, it's like we're creating these like stimulus Franken monsters. And we've done a similar sort of thing with a lot of other stuff. Like, just take food, for example. Like, you know, the people who engineer processed food, what they're doing is they're often creating these things that are not really found in nature, where there's this high combination of salty, sweet, fat, and carb all together that creates this thing that's, you know, has this intense pleasure reaction in the brain. And I think,
have you seen,
good,
have you seen UHF, the movie?
No, what's that?
There, it's a Weird Al movie, and in the movie he takes a Twinkie and he cuts it down the middle like this, like a hot dog bun, and then he puts a hot dog in the Twinkie, and then he takes Whiz cheese and he puts Whiz cheese. That's what, well, made me think of that, sorry.
Well, I mean, that's not that far away from like chicken and waffles and stuff like that. You know, it's like,
I guess
same kind of idea of like, we take these weird things and we take, you know, them all together and figure out what's the maximum like dopamine bomb we can unleash. And I think you take, you know, you do that like by mixing the sexual parts, and then you also add the enhanced like social acceptance and social awareness around it, people are going to start searching that stuff up. And like we were saying last time, like that taboo element, that element of shock, that element maybe even that injects some negative emotion into it, that can actually lead to enhanced excitement. And so, yeah, I can see how this category would be on the rise. But what do you think this means for men, Pete? What do you think this means, that now that this is becoming a more and more popular category?
Well, you know, I don't even want to think about what's going to be next, right?
Mm.
You know, if we're already here, if this is already number four, you know, how many years from now until there's a whole new category that we don't even know exists yet, that's, you know, yeah, even crazier than this.
Yeah, that's interesting. I almost don't even want to think about like what's next, because like, you know, if this stuff was prominent back when I was growing up, it would have been like, if this was like widespread, it would have been incredibly shocking, right? This isn't shocking to me now so much, but it's going to keep escalating. Porn has to keep escalating if it wants to keep enticing more people and keep, you know, everyone's poor burnt out dopamine receptors responding. They need to be able to constantly increase the novelty. That's a huge part of the neurochemical component, because that newness is what really keeps the juices flowing. But I think the psychological fallout of something like this will be big. And I think one of the biggest things is that it's going to be causing men to really, let's say, on one level, if they have a more traditional mindset, it's going to be causing them to question their sexuality and cause some potential turmoil in there about, like, you know, holy shit, what the fuck am I watching? But on top of that, if they're not trying to hold on to any sort of heterosexual identity, they will take this attraction maybe that they develop to these new forms of, you know, more popular porn, more shocking, taboo kinds of porn. They will take that as a indication of what their sexuality really is, right? Because there's definitely a school of thought out there. And this is what, like, Cenk's nephew was saying last time about how, like, oh, well, if you watch this stuff, then clearly this is your sexual orientation. And I don't think that is. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think that, you know, the way in which your sexuality spirals and, you know, escalates doesn't really have any reflection on where you naturally are. It's kind of like, it's almost like you're just rolling the dice. Like when you're watching a shit ton of porn and the way in which your tastes escalate, that's very random. It's a thing that is tied into a lot of different, like, completely chaotic variables in terms of, like, what lights up your brain, what did you stumble across at a certain time, what had you been exposed to before, what are you already desensitized to, what do you have fears around and aversions, because sometimes that stuff actually makes it impact more highly, all these kinds of things. And so it's like, either you're going to be thrown into this state of confusion with yourself over what it is you're getting off to, or you're going to be having to shift and update your identity to match what it is that you've been getting off to. And maybe this in part is why so many young people today are identifying as non-binary, right? Like, I wish we had some stats on that. Maybe that's something we could do for the next show. But I know, like, in your generation and younger, the rates of identifying as non-binary are, like, skyrocketing. They're, like, insanely high. People are telling me that it's, like, you know, 20-30% of, like, their class. You know, these are kids who are, like, in high school and stuff like that, where it's, like, there's no way, unless the water is really turning the frogs gay, okay? Like, there's no way it's that high, naturally. There's got to be something else that's at play here. And I think unrestricted access to pornography, unrestricted use and encouragement around pornography is going to cause just this chaotic spiral in the sexuality of this young generation. I think it's also happening on the older generations, but it seems like at the younger generations where your sexuality is more malleable, I just think that it's very, very dangerous because, like, you know, you set these kinds of neural pathways when you're young, they get a bit harder to change as you get older. They're much easier to, like, influence when you're young. So any young guys out there, I remember back when I was quitting porn, like the idea was that young guys can quit porn and rewire their brains more easily. Which is a pro and a con, because it's like, yeah, you can get hooked on some crazy shit more easily because you haven't had so many formative sexual experiences. But then you can also flip it back more quickly. It seems like, and the idea was that the older guys, they might take a little bit longer to reboot. Or was that what it was? Or maybe it was actually the opposite. It was the idea that the guys who used a lot of hardcore porn when they were young, they took longer to rewire because they, like, especially if they started young and then were trying to quit, like, when in their 20s or 30s. But if you, like, started using porn in your, like, 20s or 30s, then you rewired quickly because you hopefully had some more standard formative sexual experiences. At least that was the thought.
Right.
It's kind of hard to collect data on this kind of thing because it's not something that people are, you know, extremely forthcoming with.
Self-reported.
Yeah, and it's not something that, like, we collect data on. It's, like, not like, oh, well, what kind of porn did you watch before you decided to quit? You know, that seems a little bit intrusive, but clearly, you know, this stuff is being watched. It's number four. It's the number four category in the thing that's, like, half of all internet traffic, which is an absurd amount of bandwidth going to trans porn.
Aurel, the next thing that I wanted to talk to you about here is we got a post from a club member here who says, I never learned to operate under anything other than stress. nor do I have any idea how to not run away from it. Even as a kid, my focus in building stuff from Lego bricks was to escape stress. This is also the same reason why when I'm at work, all I can think about is art. How do I turn these aspects into something positive and operate under confidence rather than panic?
Yeah, this is something that I think a lot of guys struggle with, is they only know one motivational method. They know how to basically scare themselves into taking action. And the way, like, psychologically this works is you try and trigger your status deficiency reflex. So, like, your brain, your primal brain, your limbic system is very concerned with your status. And status meaning just like, where do you stand on some kind of hierarchy of good versus bad? All right. And so this exists across everything. It's like people want moral status, meaning they want to be more good than bad morally. They want to have financial status, meaning they want more money rather than less money. They want sexual status, meaning more sex rather than less sex, etc. Okay. And so people who only know how to operate under stress, what they do is they imagine, well, if I don't do this thing, well, then I'm going to be at this bottom. Okay, I'm going to be at the bottom of this hierarchy, or simply not as high up as I want to be. And then when they look at it like that, that induces a cortisol reaction. That makes their brain get all stressed out, basically. They feel like shit. And that pain then drives them to take action, because that if they take action, it starts to relieve that stress. And on some level, that's appropriate and fine. And that should be something that is part of how you do things to a certain degree. It's like, you know, if my business is underperforming, or if I'm not delivering to my clients, or I'm simply behaving beneath my own moral standards, that should induce a cortisol reaction inside of me. But that shouldn't be the main way that I motivate myself. Because that means that I pretty much only know how to get myself to do something out of fear, okay? And some guys, they make a full lifestyle out of this. They double down on it, and they really adopt this vacuous mentality where it's like, I suck intrinsically. And in order for me to get good enough, I got to earn all these status points. And if I don't earn these status points, then I'm a piece of shit, and I need to feel really bad about myself. So my success is basically going to be driven by me running away from failure. Can work, just sucks to do, generally sucks to do. And often it gets overwhelming to the point of like, oh, well, if I suck so much, well, who cares? I'm not going to sacrifice for myself because I suck. And then I'm just going to wallow in shame. I'm just going to basically try to escape myself, because since I'm bad, I'm going to try and just get away from the experience of me. And this kind of stuff is where most guys, kinds of escapism comes from. It comes from this running away from this experience of self, where they feel constantly lacking the appropriate status to feel good. And so what can you do? You know, is there another approach? And I would say, yes, there is. I actually tweeted about this the other day. It's like, I used to very much operate in this mindset. I used to think that, you know, I had to build up this storm of motivation inside of me, pretty much doing the stuff I was describing here, like learning how to get myself worked up and, you know, like worried about the negative consequences of not acting, which would throw me into a fear state. And then if you want to try and do this negative approach intensely, you trigger the stress response. And then you try and tap into the fight response, okay? And when you do that, you can find a significant amount of power, but it takes a lot of work and a lot of negative emotion to constantly tap into that fight response like that. So it's like you build up the storm and you get all fired up, and then you try and bust through a wall, you know? Like, that's the resistance. That's the wall of homeostasis, the comfort zone, as it were, okay? And it can work, like I said, but it's not fun to live like that. And so what I have moved to, and what I've come to realize, is that there is an alternative approach. All right, this is the dignified approach, where you say, all right, the status stuff, it is real. It does matter. I do want to be, you know, up here in a lot of these things. But even if I'm not, I'm good. I have intrinsic, fundamental, unconditional worth. And when we accept that, well, then we realize whether our status goes up or down, we're still okay. Now, where does the power come from then? How do we actually get ourselves to take action, because that seems kind of like inert. But what you find is that if you get good at this, you get good at operating from this place of invincible, indestructible dignity, where you are good no matter what, and you are okay no matter what, you find peace. Okay. And peace is incredible. And it's embarrassing that it took me so long to understand it, but it's kind of like, instead of trying to build this storm up inside of yourself to bust through a brick wall, it's more like you build this constant peace up inside of you that allows you to calmly walk through any storm of resistance. And so it's like, when you know you're good, all right, then the natural result of that is that you want to reflect that goodness. You want to let that goodness radiate out of you. You want to be congruent with that goodness in all of your other things. And it becomes this idea of like, well, poor behavior is actually beneath me. You know, I am intrinsically up here. And all I have to do is let that fundamental goodness of who I am just flow out into my actions. I don't need to rush. I don't need to hustle. I don't need to force and strain and have a vein popping out of my forehead. I can just walk forward in peace, calmly, one foot after another, step by step. No need to be dramatic about it. Just take the next right frickin' step. That's it. And when you learn how to operate from this place, I think you find the most powerful form of motivation. You find the most powerful form of action taking. And this is like, you know, from the Christian perspective, you know, they talk about like Jesus as the Prince of Peace. It's like, you know, Jesus wasn't like someone who was beating himself up or anything like that. He wasn't someone who felt like he had to like, you know, work himself, you know, into a frenzy by, you know, thinking about how, you know, he sucks if he fails and that sort of thing. It's like he knew who he was and he just calmly, usually, went about what he did. And even when he got heated, it was, I think a lot of that was performative. Like, I think a lot of the, you know, the cleansing of the temple and things along like that, there was an interior peace that was still there. But it's kind of like me when I'm, when my daughter's misbehaving, okay? Sometimes she's just not responding to the calm approach. She's just not responding to me talking gently to her because it's not intense enough to pierce her little three, almost four-year-old emotional barrier, okay? I need to display some negative emotion. You know, I'll act upset. I'll be like, oh, Avila, you know, and it's like, I'll maybe like put some negative energy out, but interiorly, I'm calm. I'm fine. I'm doing it in a controlled, precision manner to try and actually serve her, to help her. And I think that's in a lot of way what you know, Jesus was doing. And, you know, if you look at him as a role model for how to walk through life, then I think that's what we should be striving for, is we should be striving for an interior peace that is gained through being right with our highest conception of goodness. Because that's where this really comes from. It comes from the ability to surrender to what you believe is good. And someone on Twitter was actually asking me about this, like, well, how do I start doing this? How do I start, like, you know, like generating this kind of power? And it's like a different order of operation. So when you're doing the whole build the storm inside of yourself approach, it's like you got to do the emotional work first before you can really commit to taking the action. It's like you got to like get yourself ramped up before you can go and do the thing. The kind of peace that I'm talking about, it actually comes from a surrender first. It's a surrender to, all right, I'm going to do the best thing. That's just how I'm going to live because that's who I am. I am the best guy. And that's what I am deep at my core. And maybe the external expression of that is not perfect. And in all of our cases, usually it's not. But I'm going to claim that as who I am. And I'm going to surrender to expressing that. And then once you do that, the amount of peace that comes from knowing that you are going to do the right thing, that then fills you with this ability to then act. It's like it's the claiming the goodness first, the surrender first. And it's like there's always these polarities, right? So it's like you can try and build up dominant energy inside of yourself and then make the world submit to your will, which is, I think, very difficult to do. Alternatively, you can learn how to cultivate submissiveness to your highest conception of goodness, a surrender to your highest conception of goodness, which is this interior of peace, which then leads to outwardly dominant action. Okay. And so it seems like, you know, maybe a bit of semantics, but internally and neurochemically, these narratives you hold have an entirely different experience depending upon, you know, if you're putting them together in the way I'm describing or not. And so that would be my recommendation to this guy is like, what would happen if he just learned, if he started to try and move from this place of peace, tried to move from this place of surrender where he didn't need to scare himself. He just needed to actually just surrender himself to what he thought was best. Find that the peace in that and then let it unfold out and through his actions into the world.
You know, through personal experience, I've come to realize that there's a difference between knowing something to be true and believing something to be true. And I was shocked to find out how many things I knew were true, but I didn't believe them to be true.
Mm.
So a lot of people, I think, they will look at that and they'll say, yeah, well, I know I'm supposed to, you know, look at myself this way, but I just don't believe that's the case.
And by believe, that's more of an emotional reaction, you're saying, or is that more of a willful one?
It's more of like a when push comes to shove, are you acting in a way that reflects that?
Mm, yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So do you have any, I mean, you've worked with a lot of guys around this particular issue. So has this ever come up and what have you done to kind of navigate them through that process of coming to a place where they actually do, on a heart level, believe that they are, how do you get them to use light side energy, I guess?
Yes. Well, it really is like recognize like that distinction between belief and knowing, I think, is really essential. And it's like whether you are a religious person or not, you need to learn how to use faith, because faith, that's what belief is. Mm-hmm. All right. Like if I say I believe in the intrinsic dignity of every individual. Okay. That's not something I would say I know. Okay. You know, I know 2 + 2 = 4. That's a purely logical operation. But what I'm putting forth here is a narrative about the state of reality, which is not verifiable. It's not logically verifiable. It's just like, what angle and what perception and what story of the universe are you going to be living in and operating in? And these things have dramatic impacts on your life. They have dramatic impacts on, you know, how you deal with tragedy, how you deal with hardship, how you deal with stress. Right? It's like you're, and to shift into actual belief, it's as simple as asking yourself, well, it's like, well, what if it was like this? What if I was already good? How would I behave? Mm-hmm. What would come next? Right? And one of the big things that tends to happen to guys when they start playing around with this is that they'll think that at first they're losing power. It's like, oh shit, I don't have the power to grind at this thing anymore. And usually the reason for that is because they were grinding at something they didn't really care about. You know, that's the thing, is like you can use this dark side energy to get yourself to behave strongly in an inauthentic direction. You can't do that with the light side energy, because like you have to really believe that, like, to use the light side energy, you have to believe that what you're doing is good. And if it doesn't really click with you, that it's fully good, this path of action, you know, there's some kind of internal resistance. There's some kind of something where it's like, yeah, maybe I don't really want to just become this machine who, you know, just does this, you know, college major or this career or, you know, does X, Y, and Z. And so it's like you will lose power for those things. But what you gain access to is the power to pursue the more authentic things. So it can be quite the journey to switch from one energy system to the other. But to me, it's like that's one of the most important things that you can possibly do in this life.
100%. Yeah, that's the center right there, I tell you. Alrighty, next up, I wanted to show you this. So Tony from the Self Mastery Club, he sent this over. He tagged me in this and he said, I just got a call from my best friend's phone. His girl was on the phone, so I was a little confused. She sounded pretty serious and asked me if I had a minute. He, meaning Tony's friend, was sitting right next to her. She found pee material on my friend's phone and was about to end the relationship because she didn't know how to deal with it. She just couldn't imagine her boyfriend doing this sort of stuff. We had a long talk and I gave her some background info on how many guys struggle with PMO and that I'm on the way to becoming free as well. She kind of understood, but she couldn't deal with the fact that my friend did it because it was absolutely a no-go for her. And I know my friend. He knows me and the reboot I'm doing. But it took him until now, this morning, to understand that this has to be cut out and that this is normal, everybody does it, is not an argument in this twisted world. So I assured her that this is on him now, obviously, but I know the best resources in the world for quitting PMO. This verified to me that PMO is one of the most evil problems in the modern world and that men and women will wake up to it, mostly in hurtful ways, as some already have.
Yeah, that's a interesting phone call to get from a friend, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, not every woman's obviously going to react this way. But in my opinion, the best ones probably will. You know, the ones who have the highest sense of personal dignity, the ones who have the highest value of their own sexuality, they're going to be the ones who are most repelled by the usage of pornography. You know, they're going to be the ones who are most desirous that you give your sexuality to them exclusively, right? And I would argue that that's a good stance to take. It's the stance for the highest level of meaning in your sexual relationship with like two completely committed people where, you know, it's like as soon as you start spreading the sexuality around, it has to dilute the value. It's like you have, you know, a couple, you know, a guy and a girl, and they're both, you know, masturbating to porn, you know, looking at other people lustfully, doing all stuff like that. When they finally decide to bring their sexuality together, how much does that mean when it's already spread around so much? But then on the flip side, you've got the couple where neither side masturbates and uses porn and, you know, wants to go after other people. When they bring their sexuality together, that has a high level of meaning because it's showing that each person is making a sincere sacrifice to create something even better, more pure, more meaningful, more good with the other person. It's that sacrifice via restriction is what makes the sexual connection mean so much. And so I think that it's right for her to be upset about it, but the sad part is that most women, if they're going to find out the truth about their partner's behavior, they're going to be upset about it because most guys are using porn. And yeah, it's usually not until something pops that bubble, right? It's very easy to keep using porn while no one knows about it, especially not your sexual partner, right? And so as soon as that behavior is brought into the light, you're like, oh, shit, that's right. This is pretty fucked up. But it's like guys, they get so used to practicing this stuff in private and only usually talking about it in the context of other people who do the same thing, you know, mentioning it in passing, kind of like the quote unquote locker room talk where they're usually getting affirmation for the behavior, that once it's actually brought out into the full light, you know, into a something that kind of pierces that veil of affirmation around the porn usage, It's like a massive slap in the face. It's like this, you know, dumping cold water on them because they're like, oh, yeah, from your perspective, I can totally see how messed up that is. So, I mean, I can't tell you the number of emails that I've gotten over the years from women who are trying to help me or trying to tell me to help them to help their partner. They're trying to tell me to help their partner. It's like they're like, women who find out, oh, my partner's got a porn addiction. How do I get him to quit? How does he quit? And I'm like, well, you're not going to be able to do it for him. I'm sorry. You know, it's like he has to want this. He has to go after it. And like what Tony was alluding to here, he knows the best systems for quitting porn in the world. Guess what? The Self-Mastery Club is the stuff I'm putting out. It's the Reforged Man course. You know, hands down, I feel confident bragging about the fact that we have the best material for helping guys quit. We do. Like, I've been doing it probably longer than anyone, with more people than anyone, helped more guys quit than anyone. It's like, it's doable. All right. And if you guys want to start sinking your teeth into some of that content, just check out the link in the training, the training in the link that's in the description. Sorry, wrong day. I got it. But yeah, you do that, you can get free, but you got to want it. End of the day, you got to want it. You got to be willing to sacrifice for it. But I mean, it's the best thing that you can do for yourself. It's one of these things where it's like, it's going to absolutely transform your life. It's going to help you tap into a completely different level of self-control, self-knowledge, self-discipline. And once you quit porn the right way, not just like through white knuckling and bullshit like that, you now have a system, you know, the way I teach it, you will now have a system that you can use to conquer literally any other goal in your life. And literally every other goal in your life will be pretty easy compared to quitting porn. So it's like, this is the rite of passage for the modern man. You guys, like, if you haven't done it yet, get on it. Bury this habit, get clean, unleash your apex potential, and start becoming the man that you're meant to be. You know, you're not going to be able to do it while you're lying to yourself. You're not going to be able to do it while you're still doing this thing that you have to hide from the world because you know it's messed up, right? It's like it's like the only other alternative is you go all in. You just are open about it. It's like, yeah, I use porn. It's great. It's like, that's so cringy and gross when you see the guys online defending porn and just acting like, yeah, this is just the way it is. This is how I do it. Yeah, yeah. It's like, porn is normal. I have needs as a man. Like, that stuff is like vomit inducing to me. And I get why people would want to do that, because if they don't hold that mentality, well then, shit, what does that say about them? It says they got a problem. It says they got a serious problem. And, you know, I can understand why guys would want to avoid that. But depending on the circumstances, like our friend here realizes, you can't avoid it for forever. So, you know, good luck to them. Hopefully that his friend does come get involved in the Self-Mastery Club and we can get him clean.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. The next thing I wanted to show you was another guy in the SMC mentioned that he likes to talk smack with his buddies, but a lot of the times they don't join in and play and he doesn't know how to respond. He says, quote, I'd like to be able to do some mutual, quote unquote, male testing of this sort. It's a great way to make male friends. I don't have many, but I feel inside that it's the right and natural thing to do. Do you have similar experiences?
Yeah, it's like the guys who don't know how to do, like, you know, some shit talk. They don't know how to, like, take some friendly ribbing. You know, they don't know. It's like you razz them a little bit and they just get, how dare you? It's just like, okay, that guy is disconnected from this probably masculine culture. Okay, that's one possibility. The other possibility is that you just suck at doing it. Right? Like, there's a way in which, you know, if you're kind of tone deaf, you can either just come across as an asshole, or you can just be seen as insensitive. There, like, has to be, you have to be able to do it in a playful manner. You have to be able to do it in a way in which, like, there's already some kind of rapport built. I mean, with some guys, it can be a way to build rapport, but, like, it's got to be light. It's got to be friendly. And, like, you have to, like, communicate, especially if the friendship's not that deep yet. You have to communicate that you are on their side. You care about them. You want them to succeed. All right. Like, and if you don't have that comfort first, then it almost can seem like an attack, I guess. It's like, the more comfortable you are with someone, the more brutal you can be during the process. Like, the if you're super comfortable with a friend, then you can talk like the game is actually, how intense can the shit talk become, right? Because it gets, like, to absurd levels, and that's what makes it, like, actually really funny and hilarious. You know what I mean, Pete? Like, there's got to be a certain, you gotta gauge the level of rapport you have with the person to adjust your shit talk to that level, I would say.
You do, and yeah, a lot of people are just they're just sensitive. There's just different types of people, you know, so you have to be sensitive to that. And it's probably good that you don't treat some of your buddies the way you treat some of your other buddies, just because they're probably going to be different people. You know what I mean? At least that's been my experience, because I've run into the same thing where I want to talk smack and kind of give some buddies a good ribbing, but some guys just don't like it. And then you go into a different friend group and it's very welcome and you can scream at people and it's totally fine. So I've seen that. I've seen that too. And yeah,
it's one of these things where it's like, you need to have the experiences, right? Like,
yeah,
it doesn't help that a lot of guys today are deprived of masculine company, you know,
right.
If they were raised rather soft, right. If they're raised in a very feminist mindset, you know, it's going to be, different because women do not do this in the same way. Women are like, they go kind of the opposite direction. They're like overly nice and like they're incredibly gentle with how they, you know, do criticism and stuff like that. And so it's like if a guy was raised in that sort of culture, he didn't really play a lot of sports, he didn't do stuff like that, then he's not really going to know how to handle it. He's not going to really have the framework for it. And so, you know, it's tough. Trying to find more traditionally masculine environments to do this kind of stuff in is probably better. You know, hell, like it's like you got martial arts, you got sports, even like online video gaming. Depending on how much of a rager the people are you're playing with can be good for this sort of thing. But you know, if you're anything, the more you go into the artsy realm, probably the more carefully you would want to tread. Like if you're in a photography class or you're in a figure drawing class or something like that.
Finger painting sucks, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of like, I just remember like my entire, I took one women's studies class in college and everything about my energy was unwelcome in it. Everything. And, you know, I ended up not going to most of that class and basically failing it because even though the content was brain dead simple and I got like hundreds on all the tests, I just stopped going because it was just like, it was either go there and sleep or go there and just like get people like, how dare you? And it's like, for me, it's like, I can't just sit quietly in a class. I have to be like participating and it was not welcome. And so it's like, that's, you gotta be able to read the room. And it's not necessarily always an easy thing to do, but the more experience you have, the more clear the signs become.
You know, and one final thing too is if you're dishing it out, then you got to know how to take it. You can't be one of those guys who's, you know, just he's insulting other guys because he's not confident about himself too. And so I think that goes back to what you're saying of you might just be bad at it. I'm not accusing this guy of being this way, yeah. But I've seen it. I've seen it all over the place where guys will use it as a defensive mechanism.
And yes. That's right. And so it's like, here's one thing that you can do. This is something that I'll do if I'm trying to put someone at ease. All right. It's like, and you want to get into this more kind of playful sort of banter, is that you can start with self-deprecation, right? You can put yourself down first. And that kind of sets this framework of like, oh, yeah, oh, you know, I'm garbage at this. Oh, man, what a lousy move or whatever. It's like, you know, I suck at this, but like you're kind of laughing about it. You're not like actually being negative. You're like making, literally turning your lack of skill or ability or whatever into fun. Okay. And once you set the stage like that, you show them that it's okay. Then you've kind of created this framework. And it's like, and then it's like, you know, oh, you suck too. Okay. All right. And it's like, it's not so much of an attack at that point. It's more of like you're inviting them into this playful framework where we can look at our deficiencies, have fun with them, and then, you know, try and improve, you know, try to excel, try to do whatever it is that we're trying to do. And that seems to work pretty well as well. So maybe you could try that out.
All right. Last but not least, Mark, you got an email from this guy who makes... I mean, he sounds pretty convincing. I'm going to go ahead and read him.
Sure.
So this email here.
This email came when we were launching one of our recent Reforged Man Gold program.
Right on. Okay. So he says, NoFap. Oh, actually, no, this is important. How about you finally say the truth for once and stop monetizing losers and instead give the advice they need to hear? NoFap is not a sprint. It's a marathon. And instead of counting your streak, you should count your relapses. And if you see that they will decrease slowly month by month. But if you do these stupid repressive crap where it's all or nothing, no wonder everyone is failing. All you literally think about is to not FAP, to not FAP, to do no FAP. It becomes your stupid personality. You end up looking like an idiot and feeling like an idiot instead of doing this focus on improving your life. Do what you have to do, get disciplined, and don't be controlled by your emotions. But don't be stupid about it and think you can just shut off everything at once and just start a streak magically forever, and where so much emphasis is put on relapse for no reason at all. It should not even occur to someone who just relapsed that he did a mistake, and then beating himself up, and where you sit, then sit and prey on exactly the guys to monetize them for your courses and all that crap that they don't need, making things unnecessarily complicated just so you can get a profit. Mark, what do you have to say for yourself?
Oh, I know.
Disgrace.
I'm ashamed. Well, first of all, I feel 100% confident in saying that this guy has never quit porn. And two, he has never helped anyone else quit porn. Now, I'll give him, it sounds rational, but it doesn't fucking work.
It does.
Not even a little bit. Now, let me explain to you why. There's a bunch of things that go into this, all right? The first thing is that, like, I don't teach people to just sit there and focus on not fapping. That's a horrible idea, as you point out. It's called the pink elephant problem. It's like, I tell you, hey, don't think about a pink elephant. Stop thinking about a pink elephant. What happens? You think about a pink elephant, right? Okay, that's not what we're doing. There has to be a replacement, okay? You have to put your energy into other things, which he is also right about. You do need to put your energy elsewhere. You do need to focus on generally constructing a life that you want to live. You know, if you're living a life you want to escape from, that's going to cause a porn problem. But a porn problem is something that's very deeply ingrained. It's a very, like, perniciously embedded behavior pattern wired deeply into your neurobiology. Okay, so there needs to be specific work done to remove that habit completely. If you're going to try his approach, what the best you will get is reduce the frequency of porn use. You will almost never quit it. In fact, I've never heard of someone quitting it like this. Not even once. Not in my 10 years have I heard of someone permanently quitting porn by just focusing on the other parts of their life, because it just isn't going to do it. It's kind of like saying, like, I'm just going to focus on living the other parts of my life, and that's going to make me more fit. It's like, no, it's not. Like, in order to become more physically fit, you have to actually provide the proper stimuli to create the changes in your body. All right. Same thing happens with changing something as deep as a porn addiction. If you want to rewire your attractions, you want to rewire your stress responses, that's going to take intentional work. And that's the work you should be focusing on. You know, that plus improving the lifestyle. Yes, you got to do that, but you have to do porn specific work, and you have to target, like, all right, here's how I use porn. Here's the patterns in which I use porn. And you have to come up with specific ways in which you're not going to do those things. And this is an internal and external process. It's like, oh, I use porn when I get stressed about work. Just focusing on your life isn't going to fix that. All right. You have to come up, you have to identify, oh, I have to change these thought patterns around my work. And then I also have to find a different way, a different mode of action that replaces porn. And I have to do that. And usually to pull this off, particularly in moments of high emotional distress, which is when a lot of guys are most vulnerable to relapse, is like, you need conditioning. And so that's why we do a lot of this journal work to reprogram the brain, to actually make it so that we think the right things and do the right things in the critical moments of craving. That doesn't just happen magically, all right? It doesn't. Like, if you're just focusing on other things, yes, like I said, your usage might decrease, but typically it's a very temporary period. And what you're going to have is just periods where your usage decreases, but then you're going to have periods where you go back to binging again. And you're just like, oh, I just got to focus back on other things, and maybe it'll decrease again, but then you're going to binge again. You're never going to quit. You're never going to quit until you complete the reprogramming of your stress response to be able to stay clean, even in the moments where you're most tempted to use. All right. And that takes very intentional work. So let me see. There are some other things that he mentioned here that are worth responding to. About the streak tracking. Okay. Like, living porn free, that's something that takes a while for guys to internalize. Like, if you are going to truly try and remove porn from your life, that idea, it takes a while to sink inside of your subconscious. All right. And if you don't do that, like if you don't go after every streak as if, like, you know, your last relapse was your last one, then you're never getting used to the idea that you will stay porn free. Right. Do most guys relapse multiple times before they get clean? Yes. But until you actually start practicing this mentality of living porn free for forever, then it's never going to get built, because it's like you have to restructure your whole psychology to understand, both on the rational and the limbic level, that this is not an outlet option. And for guys who start doing this work and they start looking at it seriously, they're going to confront usually some kind of panic or fear. There's going to be this idea of like, shit, wait, never again. And that's usually going to cause like a bunch of other stuff that they're going to have to confront. It's like, well, if I don't have porn and masturbation, like, and I don't have a girlfriend right now, well, maybe I'm never going to have sexual relief ever. And it's just like a massive fear. Okay. And it takes a little while to build up your responses to that. Right. So every single time, every single streak, you want to be counting. You want to be being like, this is me trying to remove this thing for good. And as you get better and better, and you internalize this idea of like, yes, I'm actually going to leave this behind for good, it starts becoming more and more true to the point where it actually is your reality. But you're not going to get there by accident. I 100% guarantee it. So, you know, this guy, I called him a dick in the beginning because this wasn't the only message he sent me. He had a bunch of interesting ones. He was talking about like, some kind of like, some kind of weird fetish thing. And then he was also like talking about how my wife looks like a man, which she doesn't at all. She's she's very pretty. And so it's just like, I think this guy might be a little mixed up on multiple levels, but you know, I respected the points he was trying to make somewhat. Didn't like that he was trying to trash me, but I thought like this whole message was something that I think a lot of guys, they think, but they haven't actually thought all the way through, and they definitely haven't put into practice. So, you know, it is what it is. It's kind of a challenging thing. And I think like a lot of guys who promote this sort of stuff, I can guarantee you none of them are on the hook for helping anybody quit, because they're not getting anybody to quit like this. It's just not happening. I'm certain of it. So, you know, sometimes the only real path is one that seems hard, and sometimes it's one that seems stressful. Yeah, looking at your streak can seem stressful. All right. But the point isn't to beat yourself up when you relapse. The point is to learn from it. He's like, don't even think about it. It's like, yes, you got to think about it. You got to figure out exactly what went wrong. What did you think? What did you do? You know, what led up to it that caused you to make that bad decision? Oh, if we change that flow of dominoes, guess what we're going to get? A different result. And so you have to do that analysis. It's not to beat yourself up. It's going back to what I was saying before. It's like, you're good, whether you use porn or not. All right, this doesn't affect your intrinsic worth. You know, we want to stay grounded in our dignity. Just because you relapse or you screw something up doesn't mean you're bad, doesn't mean you need to beat yourself up, doesn't mean you need to wallow in shame. But it is okay to be a little upset about it, okay? It is. In fact, the brain, the limbic system, doesn't learn typically without some kind of emotional charge. And so if you can attach that negative emotional reaction to, you know, you're losing your streak, you can attach that to the poor behaviors that led you to lose the streak. Guess what? A learning event occurs. And by learning event, I mean there is a neurological reaction that occurs, a neurological event that then adds a negative weight to that previous behavior. So, for example, it's like, you know, you relapsed because you were scrolling some risky algorithm, all right? And you lose your streak, you're at like 2 weeks, and you're, God damn it, and you get upset, okay? If you just beat yourself up, nothing really is going to beneficial come from that. But if you look at that, and you're like, oh, it's because I went to this stupid website where I know that every so many pictures, there's something triggering. And you take that negative emotion you have about the lost streak, and you tie that negative emotion to viewing that website, well, guess what's going to happen? Neurological learning event. And next time you go and visit that website, or are even just tempted to visit that website, your brain's going to process it differently because it's going to remember, oh, last time we were here, there was a negative emotion that came from it. And it's going to give you this, it's going to give you pause. It's going to give, create a space where you can follow up with positive self-talk, where you can remind yourself of your goals, where you can remind yourself of what happened last time and what you really want to happen this time. Okay. So like there has to be analysis. There has to be reflection if you want to be able to really succeed in this. And tracking your streak is one of the best ways to do it because, and on top of that, when you track your streak, you also gain a lot of information about like what might happen because the journey is different for every person, but there are some general trends for what will happen around like what day mark. Like, for example, weeks 3 to 6, that's when people usually deal with the deepest emotional shit. That's when a lot of the repressed stuff starts bubbling to the surface. You know, in the earlier stages, it's more like, are you able to remember what you're doing? Are you able to, you know, have a strong motivation, like a why? You know, like, do you have buy-in? Do you have a reason why you're not doing this? And is it compelling to you? Right. And you get that, you get through the first couple of weeks. And then after that, it's like, okay, well, who am I really? What's my sexuality really for? You know, what are other ways in which I can deal with these emotional pains and these stressors that start coming up in my life? And as you start building up those responses, once you get through about week 6, it's really just like, can you avoid doing the stupid things that will cause you to relapse? And then can you also just remember what you're doing long enough to get post 90? And then usually at that point, when you're beyond 90, you know, maintaining a porn-free life becomes relatively low effort if you know what you're doing. So this is, you know, it's a good conversation piece. So I'm thankful for the email. Any thoughts on that, Pete?
No, it makes sense. You know, I think this message of it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, you know, count the relapses, not the streak, is very popular and it's gaining popularity because it's hard, you know, it's, you know, you see it all happen all the time. Get to this day done. So I can see the appeal to that, but,
well, that's not even what they're doing is they're just ignoring it. They're not even saying what day they're getting to.
Yeah.
Right. That's true. Just people want, they want to tell themselves that it's easier. They want to say that these are the people who like keep trying to find that perfect diet to let them lose weight without ever like eating less. It's like, good luck. Good luck. Yeah. You know, it's like at the end of the day, you just got to eat. You got to make sure you're getting in less calories. And everybody's going to try and sell you different ways to get around dealing with that. But, you know, you gotta do that. You know, same way with like quitting porn is like what gets measured gets improved. And if you're measuring days without porn use and you're doing it the right way, you're going to keep cranking up those days until eventually you don't even need to track them anymore because you know you're not going back.
You know, here's a quick question before we wrap this up to kind of go on that. So how many days exactly would you advise that someone keep track of? Is it 90? And then after 90, you're good?
120 is really the safe point. Usually after that point, you're pretty solid, assuming you did it without white knuckling, you know, the way that I teach it, and you've moved on to other things in your life. Like this is not meant to be, like he was talking about, oh, this is just, you're defining yourself by your nofap streaks. No, that's the exact opposite of what we're trying to do. We're just trying to eliminate this problem so that we can go about living the rest of our life full force. So it's like you have to then find another mountain to climb. That's one of the ways guys actually relapse is they do this big self-development push to quit porn. And then they're like, oh, I'm done. Ah. And they don't try. They don't continue the work. They don't continue to climb. They don't continue to do, you know, set new meaningful goals for themselves. And so it's like you got to keep going. What was your original question?
That answered it. Okay. That's exactly. Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for hanging with us, guys. Really appreciate it. If you haven't seen the free training, go ahead and click the link below and check that out. There's a lot of free tools in there that you can start implementing right away.
Yep. So we got some awesome stuff coming for you guys in 2023. We're busy scheming and dreaming on the back end here, trying to figure out exactly what order we want to start doing all this stuff in. But once we got some more clarity, we're definitely going to be letting you guys in on it. But, you know, I think the Self-Mastery Club is going to be taking some quantum leaps this year. And I'm extremely excited to share it all with you guys. But, you know, keep tuning in. You know, check out the training, like I said. or Pete said, and then also if you've got a friend who you think might like this podcast, send it to them. You know, like maybe if it's not this episode was pretty porn focused. We got other ones where we're not really talking about porn much at all. Like, find one that you think they would like, send it to them. We're trying to grow the podcast, and I think that a lot of guys, it's kind of like podcasts. In a lot of cases, they're better than silence. You know, not always. Sometimes some good silence is great, but like, you know, podcasts are great companion things, and so it's like, you know, sometimes you want a space, you want it to be kind of productive-ish, but like you're not really in the mood to do any sort of serious work. Well, I think this podcast fills that niche very, very nicely. So make sure you share it around with anyone you think might enjoy it. But that's pretty much what we have for you guys today. Ooh-yop. See you on the next one.